Iowa farmers know how to grow cars in their cornfields. Find out how on today's episode of the Microeconomics Podcast with Professor James Miller. Today's episode is titled Trade. Trade is wealth-creating magic. By moving goods around, we can make everyone richer. Let's explore some of the nuts and bolts of the microeconomic theory of trade. We'll start by considering the term absolute advantage. You have an absolute advantage in making a good if you can produce it using fewer resources than your trading partner can. So if it would take you 5 hours to make a pie, but it would take me 15 hours to make that same pie, you have an absolute advantage in producing pies over me because you can make it using lower time costs than I do. Superman has an absolute advantage in almost everything over Batman, right? Superman can do pretty much anything Batman can do, but much, much faster. The one exception, the one area where Batman has the absolute advantage is in stopping crimes where the criminals have kryptonite, because of course kryptonite greatly impedes Superman's superpowers. It's easy to see where nations would benefit from trade, where one nation has an absolute advantage in one good and the other nation has the absolute advantage in another. So if the United States has an absolute advantage in corn, whereas Japan has an absolute advantage in cars, it's easy to understand why we'd both be made richer if the United States grew corn, shipped it to Japan, and in return, Japan sent us cars. The great Adam Smith pointed out how trade can make nations wealthier. But sometimes one person is better at everything than someone else. This corresponds to a world in which Superman was not harmed by kryptonite. Then what value would Batman have? This takes us to the idea of comparative advantage. The idea of comparative advantage was thought up by economist David Ricardo. You have a comparative advantage at producing something if you can make it at a lower opportunity cost than your trading rival can or trading partner can. So let's again think about Batman and Superman, and we'll forget about kryptonite. So if Superman can do everything faster and better than Batman, does Batman have any role? I mean, should they just kick him out of the Hall of Justice? Well, no. I mean, imagine that this giant asteroid is coming down, is about to crash into Earth, it's going to kill a billion people. At the same time, Lex Luthor is robbing a bank. Well, it's clear, right, that Superman should go and try to stop the asteroid, while Batman should go and try to thwart the bank robbery. Because even though Superman would do a better job than Batman at both, you know, comparatively, Superman should be stopping the asteroid because his time is better served doing that really important thing, whereas Batman, you know, should probably just go stop the bank robbery. Let's consider another example. Let's say you really want to work for some movie star, and all this movie star ever does is act and clean. She cleans her giant mansion. Now, she's a much better actor than you ever will be, and she certainly can earn a lot more money doing it. Unfortunately, she's also a better cleaner. While it would take her 1 hour to clean her whole mansion, it would take you 8. Right? You do just as good a job, but it would take you 8 hours. So she has an absolute advantage in everything over you. But comparatively, you have an advantage over her in cleaning because, you know, for you to clean, you've got to give up 8 hours. But, you know, giving up that 8 hours isn't as costly to you as giving up 1 hour would be to the movie star. So the movie star has a comparative advantage in you in acting, but you have a comparative advantage over her in cleaning. Now, it's hard to show exactly what comparative advantage is, you know, in terms of numbers in a mere podcast. I'd sort of have to do numerical examples, and I don't want to do that. But basically, you've got a comparative advantage in what you're least bad at, and everyone is least bad at something. Let's consider a science fiction example. Let's imagine that super intelligent extraterrestrial aliens, they land on Earth and they set up a base in Antarctica. Now, these aliens really, really like donuts, and they eat lots of donuts. And they also have the ability, they also can make flying cars. So the aliens, they can produce two things. They can produce donuts and flying cars. Now, humans, we can't produce flying cars at all, and we can make donuts. But let's say the aliens are really, they're so much more advanced than us. They can make donuts 1,000 times faster than we can, and they can make them using a lot fewer raw materials. So could we trade with the aliens? Well, sure, we could go to the aliens and we could say, look, we've got this, you know, huge, giant super tanker worth of donuts. And yeah, it took us a lot more time to make these donuts than it would take you to make that amount. But please, we'll give you this whole super tanker of donuts for just a few flying cars. And we'll save you a little bit of time because you don't have to, you know, make the donuts that we're giving you. And so you'll be better off with this trade, but we'll also be better off because it's certainly worth it for us to give you, you know, these huge amount of donuts in order to get a few flying cars. The theory of comparative advantage explains why countries can pretty much always benefit from trade, even if one country is, in an absolute sense, better at producing goods than another is. So let's say we've got a poor and a high-tech country. And the high-tech country, again, can make everything really, really quickly. The poor country goes up to the high-tech country and says, look, let's trade. Why don't we sell you really cheap clothing, and in return, you can give us high-tech gadgets. So yeah, it's true, you know, you've got this industrialized production technology, and you can make this low-quality clothing, you know, it quicker than we could. But how about this? Look, we've got all this really cheap labor, and we'll use the labor to make a lot of cheap clothing. We'll give it to you, and that will save you some time. So maybe it takes us 8 hours to make a shirt, while it would take you, you know, only 8 minutes. But still, in that 8 minutes that we save you, devote 4 of those minutes to making computers for us, and we'll take those computers in return for the clothing, and maybe we'll be better off, but, you know, and you'll also be better off, so you can benefit from trade. Again, it's kind of hard to show this without doing some numerical examples, but trust me, as long as someone else can produce something that you value and you can produce something that they value, you can always benefit from trade because of comparative advantage, even if one person is in an absolute sense better able to produce goods than the other. Let's turn to the Iowa farmers who I claim can grow cars in their cornfield. Well, let's turn to science fiction, and let's imagine that the Japanese invent this machine where you put corn in and the machine rearranges the molecules in order to produce a car. And the Japanese, you know, they take the machine and they move it to the Iowa cornfields, and they say, okay, farmers, just come along and drop your corn into this machine and you'll have produced a car. So, you know, in this science fiction example, you know, the Iowa farmers could grow cars. Now, instead, the Japanese say, you know what, we're going to keep the machine in Tokyo. So, you know, just take your corn, put it on a boat, ship it to Tokyo, and then we'll put it in the machine for you, and then, you know, we'll send back some of the cars. So still, you could say, right, that, you know, Iowa farmers are effectively growing cars on their cornfields. Now, instead, say the Japanese don't have any machine that can rearrange the molecules in corn. What they have are workers who can make cars, and these workers like corn. So the Japanese say, okay, here's the deal. You put the corn on a boat, send it to Japan, and in return, we'll send you cars, right? So in this way, effectively, the Iowa farmers are growing cars. They're just doing it through trade. This is an example of what's called roundabout production. Again, roundabout production. So in order to make a car, right, an American company could directly build cars, that's direct production, or they could take a roundabout path where they produce something else that people who make cars value, and then, you know, they trade what they produce for the thing for the cars. So, you know, through roundabout production, you know, I'm able to produce cars by teaching economics classes, because I teach economic classes, I get money, and I can use the money in order to get a car. And it might well be cheaper to make something using roundabout production than through direct production. I mean, clearly for me, right, it would be impossible for me to figure out how to actually build a car. So it's much better for me to get the car through roundabout production. Well, the same could be true for a nation. You know, certainly almost every nation, if they put enough effort into it, could figure out how to build cars, but it might be far better for a country to say, well, we're going to produce cars by growing corn and then trading the corn for cars. So often through trade, you can get things at lower resource through resource costs through roundabout production. Let me discuss four other benefits of trade. One big one, and this is something Adam Smith talked a lot about, is specialization. When you specialize in something, you tend to get much better at it. So as you know, if you've got a whole bunch of people and they can all do everything, rather than having everyone be a jack of all trades, it might be more beneficial to say, okay, everyone just do one thing and get really, really good at it. So, you know, if you wouldn't want to go to a doctor who also was a plumber and a dentist and an artist and, you know, a chef, because you're thinking, okay, it's great you can do all these things, but, you know, while you're studying how to be a dentist and a chef, you weren't, you know, looking at medical texts. I mean, I'd rather go to a doctor who just spent most of his or her time studying medicine. So countries, too, benefit a lot from specialization. If different countries specialize in producing different things, they'll get better and better at it, and the world will be better at producing stuff. Second extra benefit of trade is innovation. This happens in a lot of ways, but we get more innovation through trade. So imagine an American company is thinking of coming up with a better way of building, I don't know, computer chips. And it costs a certain amount of money to do the research, and they're saying, is it worth it? Well, you know, we'd have to pay a cost to innovate, and the benefit would come from how many computer chips we sell. Well, the more computer chips you sell, the more willing you'll be to incur costs to, you know, undertake the innovation. So an American company will be more willing to innovate if it can sell to the whole world versus if it could sell to just to the United States. This is a reason that I'm personally extremely happy that India and China are getting very rich very quickly, because there's going to be a lot of extra markets for people who want to innovate. You're considering coming up with some new cancer drug, and the fact that there's a lot of people in India and China who'd be willing to buy it, that's creating incentives for pharmaceutical companies to spend more money on research. Another reason that you'll get more innovation through trade is that if you have trade, people will specialize, and the more you specialize, the more likely you are to come up with a better way of doing something, right? If you just do one task, you do a very narrow task, you're more likely to see a way to improve it. But you can only specialize when you innovate. A third benefit of trade is that it tends to reduce corruption. So let's imagine, I'll do a sports analogy, and imagine that, you know, you play basketball, and right now you just play basketball in your city, but your refs are corrupt, and everyone kind of knows this. And basically, the team that wins is the team that pays the most to the referees. Well, you know, you're not going to bother to get that good at basketball because, you know, what does it matter? You just have corrupt referees. And this is a situation in a lot of countries where, you know, the company that's able to sell light bulbs is the company that pays off the police or pays off the politicians. But now imagine that you say, well, we want to play away games. And we're going to have to play away games in places where the referees aren't corrupt or where we can't bribe the referees. Well, in order to have a chance at winning an away game, you're going to have to get good at basketball. This happens to countries too. So let's imagine you have a country, you have a company in a corrupt economy, and they know, look, we're able to sell a lot of products because, you know, politicians block our potential rivals from selling them. But now we want to sell this product in the United States, and we can't bribe American policemen to just, you know, restrict our rivals. So we're going to actually have to develop high quality products. Or, you know, if this country opens up to trade and they say, hey, wait a minute, now, you know, we were selling light bulbs because we're the only ones legally allowed to, but now my country has just signed a free trade agreement with the United States, and, you know, General Electric is going to be selling light bulbs here, and, you know, the police, they'll get in trouble if they, you know, restrict the sale of GE light bulbs. So now in order to make light bulbs, we have to be a bit honest. Well, this, you know, we have to be honest, or we have to sell high quality light bulbs. So this will give you an incentive to be more honest. So really corrupt countries can greatly benefit from trade, because the, you know, the domestic companies will now have to start pleasing consumers rather than merely pleasing politicians. The final benefit of trade I want to talk about is brain gains, right? There's a lot of very poor but smart people who, without trade, you know, let's say they live in a poor economy, they live in India, they live in Africa. Without trade, maybe the best job they could get is being an agricultural laborer. They would, you know, they would do menial work. But suddenly with trade, you know, maybe they can get a job at Microsoft or IBM. So because of trade, you have a lot of people who are really smart, and their brains can be put to better use, you know, and they could help with innovation. They can help all of mankind. Now let me turn to some commonly given objections to trade. The first is that trade supposedly harms workers in poor countries. So the idea here is, we'll say, you know, if America trades with Bangladesh, you know, maybe the shirt you buy from someone in Bangladesh was made by a 15-year-old who got paid 50 cents a day, and isn't that awful? Well, I would say, first of all, yes, it is awful if someone's paid 50 cents a day for their labor. It would be a much better world if everyone on the planet were able to earn very high wages. But to think like an economist, you have to ask, which is better? Given, you know, that Bangladesh is a very poor country, are poor people in Bangladesh better off with trade or without? So let's say, you know, there, someone is indeed with trade working for 50 cents a day. If you took away trade, what would they earn? If they would earn less than 50 cents a day, well, then you've made them worse off, and trade makes them better off. I mean, there's a lot of people on our planet who live in desperate poverty. And so if you can offer them a job that maybe pays 50 cents a day, even though to, you know, anyone listening to this podcast, that sounds horrible, maybe to them, it's a lot better. I mean, just imagine a medical analogy, right? Let's say there's an anti-cancer drug that if you take it, it's really gonna be extraordinarily painful, and there's a 50% chance it's gonna kill you. So it's you know, again, you take it, it injects into you, and you experience intense, prolonged pain. And even after that, there's a 50% chance you're going to die. Should we ban the drug? Well, you know, maybe not, right? Because maybe, you know, if someone has cancer and, you know, without the drug, they're definitely going to experience pain and death. They're better off with the drug. So you wouldn't, you know, it'd be crazy to ban the drug if the drug was better than the alternative. The key for the economic way of thinking, again, is to ask not whether overall the people who, you know, work in sweatshops and make very low wages, whether their life is, you know, good or bad compared to ours. The key is to say, is their life better or worse off because of trade? Now, why is it that someone would work in a sweatshop for, let's say, 50 cents a day? Well, it's because the alternatives are even worse. I mean, maybe the person's crazy, but probably it's because the alternatives are even worse. And this is why I don't think that, you know, in the United States, that we should be reluctant to buy goods made with sweatshop labor, as long as that labor is voluntary. Now, if there's slavery going on, obviously that's completely different. But if the people worked in the sweatshop, they did it voluntarily, then presumably they did it because it was better than the alternative. And so they're better off if we buy their clothing. Now, yeah, if I could magically make Bangladesh much richer so that no one would ever consider working for less than, say, $10 a day, I would do it. But I don't have that power, and neither do you. So, you know, if your choice is, I want to buy this shirt, but gee, I feel bad because I know it was made with sweatshop labor. Well, yeah, you should buy the shirt. That's actually the morally right choice, because you are helping the people who made it. Assuming, of course, that it was made with voluntary labor, and the people who made the shirt, they were better off working in that sweatshop than they were in any alternative. Another objection to trade is the so-called infant industry argument. This argument goes that, gee, if we were to allow, you know, free trade in, say, cars, then the car manufacturers in our country would never get started. So what we do is we need to protect our car makers until they could get really strong, and then we could allow trade. Otherwise, if we just allow free trade in cars from the very beginning, we'll never be able to start a car industry. This argument is, I think it's very weak. First, if it were possible, if you somehow knew that, yeah, you know, car makers in our country for a while they'd lose money, but then they could eventually figure out how to make quality cars and earn a profit, if that's true, then the car makers should be able to borrow money. I mean, companies like Amazon, you know, they lost money for a very long time, but they were able to convince investors that, you know, they would eventually be able to earn a profit. Another problem with an infant industry is that once, you know, you're treated like an infant, you don't have an incentive to grow up. So if you allow the car industry, you know, you say governments impose restrictions on trade and the car industry starts to grow, they get a lot of workers, and, you know, they're never really going to want to allow free trade in cars. And the bigger the domestic car industry gets, the more workers will lose their jobs if you allow free trade in cars. So it's actually going to be hard to ever remove the protection. So again, if you treat an industry like an infant, that industry has no incentive to grow up. Also, you know, if you impose restrictions on the car industry, the people in the industry are going to know what's most important to us is to appeal to politicians, because we continue to survive because of trade restrictions. So we're going to put our effort into pleasing politicians rather than pleasing our customers, and that's going to be not very good for the customers. Okay. Another objection to trade, and this one I think is legitimate, is that, you know, since trade tends to make everyone richer, you don't want to trade with enemies, because trading with the enemies can make them richer as well. So this is why the United States doesn't trade very much with North Korea. You know, if we were to trade with North Korea, it would make the United States richer, but it would also make North Korea richer. But North Korea, you know, repeatedly likes to go on about how they want to like bathe our country in fire or something. So I'd say it's probably better off. We're, you know, if I'll make this numbers up, but if we would gain $10 billion in trade from North Korea and they would gain $10 billion in trade for us, it's probably worth it for the United States to sacrifice to take the $10 billion hit in order to make them poorer as well, because they're going to use their money, a lot of their money, to buy military weapons. Now, the counter to this is that if you trade, you're more likely to discover friendships and develop common interests, and you're less likely to want to go to war. So perhaps if we were to trade with North Korea, they'd start liking American goods, they would realize that we're not their enemies, and, you know, then we'd be less likely to go to war. The next objection to pure free trade is that doing so forecloses the retaliation strategy. So let's imagine that Japanese car makers are refusing to let American cars be sold in their country. So let's just pretend the Japanese car makers are politically very powerful, and they've convinced their government to say, hey, we're not going to let American cars be sold in our country. Now, it might be reasonable for the United States to say, okay, we want to put pressure on the Japanese government in order to let American cars be sold in Japan. And we're going to do this by punishing Japanese car makers. We'll say to them, okay, look, if you don't let us, you know, try to sell cars in your country, we're not going to let you sell cars in our country. But, you know, if you're willing to let us sell you cars, we'll let you sell us cars. And, you know, this can potentially work. Of course, it's dangerous because companies will also try to get politicians to block trade by claiming they need to do it through retaliation. So retaliation can be kind of a fig leaf for politicians in order to justify putting restrictions on trade. Let me go into a bit now, why is it that politicians very frequently do object to free trade? First, I think because when you have trade, the benefits are diffuse while the harm is concentrated. So what I mean is, you know, let's imagine the United States did not allow any importation of cars. This really, really would help U.S. car makers, but it would hurt pretty much everyone else in the country. However, everyone else wouldn't be hurt that much. They wouldn't be harmed as much as the car makers would be helped. So people who make cars, they would put a lot of effort into lobbying congressmen and to running ads saying, gee, isn't it great that we have a strong American car industry? Whereas the rest of America, you know, the rest of us, we would be paying more for cars and our cars wouldn't be as good, wouldn't be as safe. You know, we would have other things. You know, most of us wouldn't vote on just that issue, whereas auto workers probably would. So whenever you have concentrated interests politically, they often tend to beat diffuse interests. Another reason I think that a lot of politicians often oppose free trade is that the benefits of free trade are often unseen, while the harm is seen. So again, going back to the car analogy, if suddenly we were to allow free trade, you know, there'd be American workers who would lose their jobs, you would see this, but the price of cars in the United States would go down and America would get higher quality cars, but it wouldn't be obvious that was because of trade, right? I mean, most of you, when the United States significantly restricts trade in sugar. Now, you're probably not aware of that. You don't realize when you go to the store, you're paying more for soda or anything with sugar in it because of restrictions on trade. However, the benefits of restriction trade on sugar, those are very obvious to the sugar producers. And similarly, if we were to allow, say, you know, cheap Brazilian sugar to come into the United States, the harm, the American workers who'd lose their jobs, that would be obvious, while the gains and lower prices of sugar, you know, people aren't really going to connect that because you don't tend to pay attention that much to small changes in price. The final objection to trade is the Santa Claus problem. Now, let's consider the poor plight of toy makers, right? Toy makers have to compete with Santa Claus' elves. I mean, Santa Claus has this magical workshop in the North Pole. He's got elves, and I don't think the elves are slave labor. They seem to be just personally devoted to Santa Claus. But man, they work for pretty much for free. And Santa Claus has this amazing transportation system where he can, you know, just fly around people's homes around Christmas and drop, you know, presents in the chimney, and they just all seem to make it. So you're a toy manufacturer. Man, how can you compete with Santa Claus? You can't. So isn't this an argument for banning Santa Claus? I mean, should the United States, you know, send one of its special military teams to go and kill Santa Claus for all the harm that he does to our toy manufacturers? Well, no, of course not. Because the purpose of an economy really is to generate wealth. It's to generate stuff people like to consume. So it's fantastic that American kids, you know, kids throughout the world get all these free toys on Christmas. If we were to kill Santa Claus, you know, wipe out all of his elves, sure, that would make jobs for toy manufacturers, but it would also take away jobs. It would also hurt people. I mean, because we get free toys, you know, during on Christmas, that means that, you know, American parents don't have to spend that money on toys. Instead, they're spending on other things. Maybe they're going out to restaurants. So because of Santa Claus, there's more demand for waitresses. The same applies with goods cheaply produced in other countries. So let's imagine in China, they come up with a way of really, really cheaply making steel. And American steelmakers say, wait, you've got to cut off all trade with China, because if you don't, you know, all the American steelmakers are going to lose their jobs because we just simply can't compete with Chinese steel production. Well, the problem with that argument is you'd say, you know, if Americans spend a lot less money on steel, they're going to have extra money and they're going to spend that money on other things. Again, they'll use the money maybe to buy more presents or to buy more books or to go out to the restaurant more or to spend more money on colleges. So it's, you know, it doesn't make sense to say that we should ban the importation of cheap Chinese goods any more than we should, you know, try to kill Santa Claus. And let me end on that note. Microeconomic theory very, very clearly establishes that we should not try to assassinate Santa Claus, even though he is greatly harming the U.S. toy industry. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Microeconomics Podcast. Next episode, we'll talk about costs. Goodbye.